One of the problems always that preachers have is knowing how to preach narrative sections like a story from Daniel. And I think one of the most compelling ways to preach it is actually to follow the storyline with the congregation, but try to alert them to the inner interest, the theological or moral or whatever interest it is you feel the author has, the narrator has, in the way he's telling it, and help them to engage with that inner line, which otherwise they might have missed if they just stayed on the surface of the story all the way through. Stories have a great power to carry people along and help them to identify. And it's an exciting way to preach, to follow the storyline through, just as it is in the text, but help people to see how the narrator is pursuing his theological agenda, his theological interest as he does that. And maybe I can try and show you a bit of how that might be done with Daniel 6. We'll break it into three parts. We always have to have 3 points in our sermons, don't we? And the story does have 3 movements, I think. Verses 1 to 9, the law the government passed. And then verses 10 and 11, the law Daniel broke. And then finally, the law God overruled. Now let's look at the law the government passed, then, going back to those first couple of verses. And this chap, Darius, maybe we should just mention a little bit about that. Scholars have argued a good deal about who he was, of course, haven't they? The city of Babylon, in which the book of Daniel is set, was captured by Cyrus and integrated into the newly emergent empire of the Medes and Persians at the very end of Daniel's life. The only Darius archaeologists can find evidence of came to the throne 8 years after Cyrus's death. And skeptical commentators particularly conclude that the narrator of Daniel has got his history muddled up. But that's very hard to believe, that he could confuse two emperors of this importance. The rest of the Old Testament attributes the fall of Babylon quite clearly to Cyrus and distinguishes him quite clearly from his later successor, Darius. So the Old Testament as a whole is in no doubt or confusion about these two men. The book of Ezra mentions both of them as emperors in the correct order. So even if the author of Daniel was writing, as some scholars want to suggest, many years after the event, he could not have made such an elementary mistake, I don't think. He mentions Cyrus, of course, by name in verse 28, the very end of this chapter, so he did know about him. There are two possibilities, I think, that are worth consideration. The first is that Darius and Cyrus are one and the same man. It's not impossible that the king had several names in the ancient world, and those who take this line argue that 6 verse 28 should be rendered as the NIV margin does. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, that is, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. That's a perfectly legitimate interpretation of the Aramaic, and it may very well be the right explanation. Darius in that case may be a throne name, a title, more than a name. Personal name. Alternatively, this Darius may be some senior figure in the government of Cyrus who was given jurisdiction over the conquered province of Babylon in his empire. Some support of that line is that the author of Daniel seems himself to distinguish Darius from Cyrus on the grounds of their ethnic origin. He talks about Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. Once more, if you look at chapter 9, verse 1, Daniel himself says that Darius was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom, a phrase that might suggest he was not emperor himself but appointed to office, presumably by Cyrus. So the fact that archaeology hasn't so far turned up any references to such a region ought not to give us too much worry. King Belshazzar of chapter 5, who we'll look at a little bit next week perhaps, was regarded as completely fictional by liberal scholars, until his name was discovered on a Babylonian document some years ago, and the same may turn out to be true of this Darius. But whoever Darius was exactly, for the purposes of the story, it's enough simply to note that he had plenipotentiary power in Babylon to organize that province in the Medo-Persian Empire as he wished. And he was quick to spot the asset he had in Daniel in that respect, wasn't he? A man who, remember, at this time must have been getting on for 80 years of age. Did you realize that when Daniel was put in the lion's den, he was probably 80 years old? But he had clearly lost none of his administrative skills. I don't know whether this means that some of us should take heart about our pastoral ministries and refuse to retire, or whether we should refuse to accept the resignation of some of our senior elders. I wouldn't like to rest too much on it. But certainly Daniel, well, maybe he was exceptional. Verse 3, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities, the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Now, let me say again, for the original Jewish readers of this book, Daniel's record of success in the service of the Persian Empire was, of course, highly relevant. As we mentioned earlier, as exiles, they had to decide to what extent it was right for them to get involved in pagan society. Would it compromise their faith to identify and cooperate with the Persian imperial authority, or indeed with the later authorities of Greece and Rome? Well, the answer the book of Daniel provides for those Jews in the exile and in dispersion is no, no compromise is involved, provided you are careful to retain the moral standards God requires of you. And this is a lesson of great importance for us as Christians, too. You still do, don't you, encounter every now and again the person who seems to think that he or she can only serve God in a really acceptable fashion if they become a pastor or a missionary. Anything less than full-time service is spiritual second best. Well, of course, that's nonsense, isn't it? Daniel, one of the greatest heroes of the Bible, held office in pagan Babylon. And that was God's calling to him, prophet though he was. Now the day may come when it will no longer be possible for us to be full-time preachers. The office of prophet may no longer be a full-time occupation in this country. Well, that doesn't mean we can't still be preachers. The office we have in IBM or Shell or Barclays Bank or whatever may be God's calling to us, Christians though we are, and we may well exercise a most important spiritual ministry among God's people and in the world through that means. No compromise involved, on the contrary, living up to the moral standards of the Bible in the secular world as Daniel did provides opportunity for Christian witness, which no full-time pastor or missionary can ever have. However, this story does contain a cautionary note, doesn't it? If you're going to be called to serve God in such a secular environment, surrounded by this paganism of which we spoke earlier, then you have to be ready to encounter hostility. That question at the end of last time was exploring the kinds of hostility which already we're beginning to experience when, as Christians, we want to become involved in a society which doesn't support the exclusive claims of Christianity any longer. And that's what Daniel found. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We'll never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." Now that phrase, the law of his God, is significant in this story because this is a story all about law. The law of Daniel's God versus the law of the Medes and Persians. What these verses, of course, show is that there's nothing new at all about a dirty tricks campaign. You remember we were hearing about that not so long ago? Daniel's colleagues had it in for him and were determined to find some way to discredit him in Darius' eyes. One can think of a variety of possible reasons for that. No doubt their animosity was motivated partly by professional jealousy. Daniel was better at his job than they were, and was clearly in line to be promoted over their heads. Well, nobody likes that. Partly, too, there may have been an element of racial prejudice. Though Daniel's Semitic origins would not have mattered to Darius, because he was a foreigner himself in Babylon, of course, to the indigenous remnant of Nebuchadnezzar's administration, the privileged position these Jews in the royal court had won during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar some years before must have been a permanent running sore. Way back in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's day, we detect the same jealousy. And some suggest, and I think there may be a case for it, that the action of these satraps may have been an attempt to preempt a crackdown upon corruption in the civil service. They may well have anticipated that a man of Daniel's stamp, once he was given authority over the whole of the province, would instigate some real crackdown on abuses of power. Installed as governor, he would be formidable. I'm told by one young economist in Cambridge, a very brilliant young fellow, that there is now in Britain an organisation called Whistleblowers Anonymous, for people who feel they have been discriminated against as a result of their determination to expose corruption in high places. Well, it could well be these satraps were seeking to make Daniel the sort of patron saint of that organisation. And fourthly, on top of all these possible motives for their political chicanery, we must not underestimate, must we, an irrational, dare I say, demonic element in this conspiracy. For Daniel was not just a good man, he was God's man. In fact, dare I say it, he was a tiresome obstacle to any satanic attempt to turn the Medo-Persian Empire against the Jews and thus thwart God's declared purpose of bringing his people back from exile. There are strong reasons, as we shall see in our final study in 2 weeks' time, for believing that Daniel's presence in Babylon and his persistence in intercessory prayer were a key plank in God's strategy in that respect. Daniel's prayer life was important in the bringing back of the Jews to the promised land. So behind the envy and the vindictiveness and the Machiavellian cunning of his colleagues in office, it may very well be, in my view, that Daniel was experiencing the subtle manoeuvrings of what the Apostle Paul calls principalities and powers in the heavenly realms, of which, as I say, more in 2 weeks' time. Note that the first thing these folk tried was the sordid tactics of what you might call Sunday newspaper journalism, spying on his every move to see if they could rake up some muck against him. But Daniel has no skeletons hiding in his cupboard. He's clean, too clean to impeach. The only way we're going to trap this chap, they said, and get rid of him, is by engineering a situation in which, paradoxically, the very earnestness of his high principles would be the death of him. So verse 6, the administrators and the satraps go as a group to the king and say, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Poor old Darius, you see, manipulated by this sycophantic flattery. He didn't recognise the frame-up, did he? The frame-up into which he was now unwittingly becoming an accomplice. It all sounds so plausible. Politically prudent, even. It will be good for the unity of the empire, they would tell him. It would ensure everybody's allegiance to his new regime, now he was governor. Of course, it did involve a minor infringement of personal liberty, but no reasonable person could object. After all, it was only a short-term measure, 30 days, and it didn't require anybody to actually do anything. It was a temporary prohibition, that's all, like banning smoking on the tube or alcohol at football matches. In a pluralist environment, it was almost impossible to imagine that anybody could object to so innocuous a decree. A small gesture to make clear to everybody the absolute nature of Persian imperial rule, that's all it was. By comparison with many of the insane and oppressive edicts prescribed by other ancient kings in celebration of their divinity, this was a most modest measure. Darius was, in fact, a most enlightened king, particularly if he was Cyrus, we know from other sources he was. But that's the point. Even modest and innocuous measures can become instruments of tyranny when they are enforced inflexibly and without regard to individual conscience, where the jurisprudence of positive law holds sway. Verse 8. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be annulled. Now, many commentators suggest that the irrevocability of Persian law is being mocked in this story, and that that's why the narrator keeps chorusing this catchphrase. You notice he says it in verse 8, again in verse 12, again in verse 15, the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be annulled. And undoubtedly there's truth in that. The whole point of this story is that Persian law is not as immutable as it makes out. But it will be a mistake to caricature this aspect of Persian legislation as some pompous eccentricity. There is no doubt in my mind at all that Cyrus had good reason for establishing such a framework of immutable statutory law in his empire. Now think about it. It is the largest empire the world has ever known. It welds together a whole host of older nations and empires, each with their own independent traditions. Now, in such a pluralist atmosphere, it was vital to create respect for law and order. And one way of doing that is to make sure everybody realizes that throughout the empire there is only one law for everybody and no exceptions to the rule. I've no doubt at all that this distinctive principle of jurisprudence, that any law written down and signed by the emperor was to be enforced without fear or favour, was regarded as fine testimony to the superiority of the Persian legal system. There was a scientific rigour in it which John Austin would have found most satisfying. Nobody was ever in any doubt what the law of the Medes and Persians was. It was written down. It could never be evaded by a whim of the judge or even by the emperor himself. It was the very acme of positive law. Law was what the government decreed. People could have their own various moral opinions by all means if they wished. Pluralist tolerance was the name of the game in the Persian Empire, provided they realized that their speculations about natural justice had nothing whatsoever to do with what was legal. The clear and unambiguous statutes of government came first. The vague and imprecise arguments of moral conscience definitely came second. Like the law of gravity, you see, the law of the Medes and Persians was absolutely predictable, absolutely certain. And unfortunately, for a man of God like Daniel, such a view of law was absolutely unacceptable. For he knew of a higher law, the law of God. And it was loyalty to that law of God that made him vulnerable in this pagan society, as his enemies were quick to exploit. So look at the second phase of the story in verse 10. The law which Daniel breaks. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Now this model of private devotion to God, which Daniel provides for us here, though incidental in the plot, would once again have been enormously relevant to the Jews in exile and in the dispersion for whom this story was originally written. For, of course, the great challenge again, as we've said repeatedly, for them was, how do you retain your holiness as a special people for God when all the outward trappings of religious privilege have been taken away from you and you're surrounded by pagan idolatry? You have no temple, you have no priesthood, you have no liturgy. The corporate worship, which has been the heart of Judaism for centuries, is now impossible. Is it not inevitable that they'll be absorbed into Babylonian culture? How can the Jews survive spiritually on their own? Well, Daniel is here, quietly, in this story, pointing to the answer. Through one's private devotional life, it says. The people of God don't need a temple, they don't need a priesthood, they don't need a liturgy. No matter how isolated he or she may be, through prayer, Every individual believer has personal access to God. And the same, of course, is true for us. Prayer is a vitally important component of our relationship with God because it's one thing that can never be taken from us. It never was more vital than to teach our people to pray on their own. To have a vital personal prayer life. That is the one thing that can never be taken from us. Notice the regularity of Daniel's praying. This is no desperate last resort, is it? It's a daily discipline. Unlike Islam, of course, there is no law in Judaism specifying how often prayer should take place. Not in Old Testament Judaism, anyway. But clearly, Daniel had decided that three times a day was a good pattern for him. I suspect we need to do something rather similar to work out how to schedule prayer, personal prayer, into our regular routines. That's what Daniel has done. He isn't following a biblical guideline here. He's making up his own personal discipline of prayer to help him survive in this pagan society that he belongs to. Notice, too, in passing, the posture of Daniel's praying. He got down on his knees, we're told. Now, once again, there's no rule in Scripture about how you should sit or stand or kneel when you're praying. But I don't think that means posture is irrelevant. The point here is this. Daniel was an important man. Most of the time, in the course of his job, juniors got down on their knees to him. If they did not fall prostrate before him. This was the standard way in which you approached a person of senior rank in the Babylonian and Persian empires, through body language. Clearly then, he felt it was important when he approached God that he consciously abandon any trace of pride which his secular vocation may have engendered in him. And adopt in his attitude the self-same attitude of supplication and humiliation which others had to adopt before him. He was now addressing the real king, the real emperor, when he prayed. So he got down on his knees. That was the point for Daniel's point of view. And I think it is probably true that the richer we are, the cleverer we are, the more powerful we are in worldly terms, the more important it is for us to get down on our knees when we pray. And the more uncongenial, perhaps it will feel to get down on our knees when we pray. Thirdly, notice the direction of Daniel's praying. We're told it was towards Jerusalem. Now that's important, not because of any superstitious idea about turning east, because of course for him it was turning west, wasn't it? But the reason it's important is that if you turn to Daniel 9, you'll find that Daniel himself gives us an example of the kind of prayer which he was offering at this vital time in his life, the first year of King Darius. Now again, we'll look at this probably in a couple of weeks' time, but you might like to just glance forward to it. You see, the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, Daniel 9, we're told that Daniel was there offering a prayer of confession for the sins of his people. He was recognizing before God that they were being duly punished in exile according to the covenant law of Moses for their moral and spiritual apostasy. It was a prayer of confession. It was a prayer, too, of petition, pleading the promise of God through Jeremiah that the exile would be of limited duration and begging God that with this change in the political climate of Babylon, there would be, in the providential mercy of God, a speedy restoration of the Jews to their homeland. Daniel is a political strategist. He understands the times in which he lives. He sees that this change of regime could very well be the means God would use to bring the Jews home. A new regime was in power, a more liberal regime than Nebuchadnezzar's. This could be the signal that the prophecy of Jeremiah will come true. And Daniel is praying most earnestly that in the mercy of God that may be so. So you see, this was no self-indulgent meditation. This is no
not what Joyce Huggett would illustrate in Listening to God, you know. It's not that sort of piety that we're talking about here. Daniel is engaging here as a prophet in a crucial intercessory role to fulfill, on the behalf of the people of God, God's plan. And no satanically inspired conspiracy was going to stop him praying along that line. And that's the fourth thing that's worth noting about his praying. The resolution of it. When he learned that the decree had been published, he went down to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem, and three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed. Now, I have no doubt that a man as sharp as Daniel was knew exactly what his rivals were up to. He'd been in politics all his life. He knew a frame-up when he saw it. As soon as he heard of the king's decree, he must have smelt a rat and guessed that he was being set up. And that he quite deliberately refuses to be intimidated here is very noteworthy. It would have been so easy, wouldn't it? Recognizing the trap, to stop praying for the 30-day period. After all, you couldn't argue there was any sin involved. He'd chosen to pray in this way. He could choose not to do so. There was no verse in the Bible that said thou shalt have a quiet time three times a day. He could at the very least have changed the venue. He could have made it somewhere a little bit less obvious. Or prayed in a different place every day for security's sake. But you see, that would have been a sellout. It takes us right back to that first story, when he refuses to eat the king's food. It would have been a sellout. Prayer for him was the bottom line in this situation. No government could make prayer illegal. Any government that tried to make prayer illegal had to be disobeyed. For it was clear that such a government had a completely erroneous and unacceptable view of its legislative power. Darius had to discover, as Nebuchadnezzar had to discover, and Belshazzar before them, that there is a higher law than the law of the emperor. Now, you'll notice that Daniel's civil disobedience was not particularly loud. The observation that the windows opened towards Jerusalem probably implies that Daniel could be seen from the street if he were nosy enough to look. But I think it would be quite wrong to conclude, as some have done, that there was anything ostentatious about Daniel's prayer times. On the contrary, it seems to me, his policy was to go on praying inconspicuously in his own home as he had done before. That's exactly what we're told. He just went on doing what he'd always done. There was nothing deliberately provocative or defiant. Indeed, if you think back to the story of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, there simply was nothing deliberately provocative or defiant on that occasion either. He just courageously and quietly continued to do what he'd always done. In so doing, of course, he exposes, doesn't he, the cowardice of so much of our Christian testimony. For many of us shirk these days, even the nailing of our colours to the mast, in that mild degree. We don't want people to see us praying under any circumstances. It's far too embarrassing. Indeed, some of us, I think it's John Stott, who uses the picture of frightened rabbits, who spend their days furiously looking for Christian burrows to hide ourselves in, for spiritual safety. Our whole life is carefully structured so that we're as invisible as possible to the surrounding world. Well, not so Daniel. He knew his rivals had been gunning for him with hostile intent, but he doesn't try to stop them or to foil their little plot. He goes on doing what he'd always done, putting God first through his regular times of prayer, and waited for them to take the opportunity to spring the trap. Well, as I say, King Darius, in his unawareness of the situation, had fallen into the trap of positive law. Just like Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar before him, he'd failed to realize that there is a sovereign God in heaven who overrules the actions of men and whose law takes precedent over every human government who cannot be thwarted, even by the law of the Medes and Persians. And it was Daniel's business to testify to that sovereign God and his law in the public arena where God had placed him. And so we come to the final movement in the story. The law God overruled. Verse 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Didn't you publish a decree that during the next 30 days anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be annulled. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. And when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Now you see, it's quite clearly not just Daniel who has been trapped. It's the king also who has suddenly discovered he is the victim of the inflexibility of his own judicial system. Desperately, he consults with his legal advisers to find some loophole in this situation. But no, the empire is committed to the ideological doctrine of positive law. No matter how unfair you think it is, O king, no matter how contrary to natural justice, the rule of law must stand. If you spare Daniel, the whole credibility of Persian law and order will be thrown in doubt. You can't afford to lose face like that. People must know that if they disobey your command, they will pay the price. Go soft, and you invite wholesale anarchy. Tell people they're free to do as they feel their conscience directs, to offend the law on the grounds of their religion or their morality, and the whole empire will fall into disrepair. I suppose if the civil service had been behind Darius in this matter, then they might have succeeded in hushing up the whole affair. But it was obvious to Darius that Daniel's rivals had engineered this frame-up, and they were not going to let the emperor off the hook. They go as a group, verse 15, "Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." There was no way he was going to be able to do a snow job, as the Americans say, on this particular issue. So after an entire day of frantic legal consultation, Darius realizes he's in a political corner and he's got no way out. He resembles in some ways a hacker in Yes Minister, you know, who's been really stitched up by his civil service. Verse 16, "So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. And the king says to Daniel, 'May your God whom you serve continually rescue you.'" There's an admission for the king to be reduced to that. "A stone is brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and king seals it with his own signet ring and with the ring of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. And then he returns to his palace and spends the night without eating, without any entertainment being brought to him, and he can't sleep." The hunting of lions was a royal sport in the Persian Empire, and so it's not strange that Darius had a private supply of these beasts, as some scholars have suggested it was. And it says much, I think, for the humanity of the man that he suffers such pangs of guilt and anxiety that night. Unable to sleep, we're told, unable to watch TV. He's cursing under his breath, isn't he, for being so stupid, for allowing himself to be taken for such a ride, for playing into the hands of his civil service in this way, trying to play God. It was infantile, and he should have recognized it for the ploy it was, but now it's too late. The best man in his cabinet is on death row. Unless the God Daniel tells about really is something special, of course. So at the first light of dawn, verse 19, the king gets up and hurries to the lion's den. He comes near, he calls to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answers,
O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me. And the king is overjoyed. Well, it's not hard, is it, to see what a tonic to the morale this climax to the adventure would have been to those exiled Jews. Of course, the Bible never promises that when the people of God stand up faithfully for him at the risk of their lives in this way, the outcome will always be a happy one. It's no accident the Greek word for witness is martyr. In that connection, it's worth just noting that little comment which Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego make in chapter 3, verse 18. Where they reply, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. That conditional, even if he does not, is a vital little phrase, isn't it? Some would argue, of course, that they should not even have considered the possibility of God not intervening miraculously in their defense. One hears all the time of people claiming deliverance of one sort and another in this kind of way, insisting that we should believe unconditionally that God is going to do what we want him to do. And one has heard people blaming the failure of prayers for deliverance of one sort or another on lack of faith. If we believed hard enough, we'd have got what we prayed for. But that isn't biblical religion, it's superstition. It treats prayer like some magic spell which has divine power and puts that divine power at human disposal. Which is not so. God always exercises his power of discretion and veto over all our prayers. And only a megalomaniac would pray if that were not so. You only have to think of the mischief which being given three wishes in fairy stories always produces, to realize that we human beings are not wise enough to have unconditional access to omnipotence. If God were to answer our prayers of faith unconditionally, we would do the most appalling things. Thank God our prayers will only be answered in accordance with his will. And there's no lack of faith in confessing that. These three men qualify their assurance with the phrase, even if he does not, in a way not unlike the Master himself qualifies his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. For the object of biblical faith is God in his sovereign power and his sovereign purpose. And it's a mark of that faith that it has equal confidence in both of those divine attributes. Remember the plea of the leper that's recorded in Mark 1. If you are willing, you can make me clean. That conditional clause expresses confidence in Christ's purpose. If you are willing. The main clause, confidence in his power. You can make me clean. But there's no lack of faith expressed in that conditional prostasis. True faith is always dependent upon the divine purpose and submits to it. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. There's a vital lesson in that phrase, even if he does not, that we should draw our people's attention to when they talk about prayers for deliverance. Indeed, it's worth remembering that in Hebrews 11, there are plenty who were not rescued, as Daniel was rescued, but who are nevertheless commended for their faith. Having said that, though, it's clear that this miraculous deliverance is intended for our encouragement. The law of the Medes and Persians was not as unchangeable as they made out. The sovereign penal sanctions of God turned hungry lions into docile pets. God turns the immutable statute of Darius upon the heads of those who corruptly extracted it, even, doesn't he? Verse 24. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den with their wives and children. Cruel, undoubtedly. But at least it does suffice to prove in the story that the lions were hungry, which some might be disposed to doubt. And more importantly, in the ancient world, of course, such poetic justice was considered a necessary deterrent against malicious accusation and false testimony. There is a final irony here, isn't there, that Darius issues another, presumably immutable, written edict, not this time forbidding prayer, but commanding it. And he really should have thought of this in the first place. I'm surprised after a night of sleeplessness, he hadn't thought of it. If you can't repeal an act, pass another one that contradicts it, and then let the lawyers of jurisprudence law sort it out. So King Darius writes to all peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and his kingdom will not be destroyed, and his dominion will never end. Now you see, we've learned a lot of interesting lessons from this story. The validity of a secular calling in a pagan society for a man or woman of God, that's an important lesson. We've learned the importance of private devotional life, particularly when we have to survive without the support of corporate worship in a pagan society. We've been reminded, too, of the reassuring truth that God is sovereign over all the affairs of men, and the hairs of our head are numbered, so no ultimate harm can come to a believer, even if we're called to be faithful unto death, as Daniel was. All these lessons are of vital importance, but supremely, let me draw your attention to the importance of Daniel's stand against the godless arrogance of positive law here. The ultimate cause of so many miscarriages of justice in this world is not that governments enact bad laws or that courts enforce bad laws, but because governments and courts, in their proud autonomy, think they have the right to make law in the first place. I say again, we don't. For true law is never made, but found. Its cogency rests not on the arbitrary dictate of a human legislature, but the eternal and unchanging character of God. Now, in earlier centuries, jurists understood this in this country. Blackstone, one of the architects of the British Constitution in the 17th century, in his great work on law, which foundational document of the British Constitution, argues there that the Ten Commandments are the foundation upon which the common law of England rests, and that no government legislation could contradict the Ten Commandments. Believe that. The same goes for our friends in the United States. It's a fundamental principle of the American Constitution that there is a higher law than the American Constitution to which that Constitution refers. Throughout Britain and American history, the issue of liberty has turned on the existence of that conviction that there is a higher law than that of the state. You may call it natural justice, you may call it equity, you may call it conscience, call it what you will, the Bible calls it the law of God, God's eternal character. And there can be no free society unless the superiority of that claim is acknowledged. Just what happens in a society where that claim isn't acknowledged is well exemplified by what happened to Germany in the 1930s. German lawyers in the 1930s were among the most extreme advocates of constitutional or positive law, as it's now called. And many of them, like the jurist Radbruch, learned to their cost the moral blindness to which such an emphasis can lead a people. For the Nazis deliberately exploited the German attitude of subservience to statutory law. And ironically, as in Daniel's case, it was of course once again the Jews who were the target of their malicious abuse of the legal system. The Bill of Rights, which is a fundamental legal instrument in the European Court in Strasbourg these days, is born out of that experience. The statutes of Hitler were contrary to justice and should not have been obeyed, said the judges at the Nuremberg trials. But they had to appeal to natural law to come to such a verdict. I'm afraid we are a little bit naive if we think a Bill of Rights in this country, important as it is, and increasingly important as it is, can preserve us, for sure, from such abuses in the future. The growth of positive law continues in this country. In Britain, legislation in Parliament is what gives rise to it. Increasingly, the House of Commons is the only body which can have an effect on what the law of the land is in this country. It becomes potentially increasingly an instrument of tyranny. In the United States, the judiciary of the Supreme Court, in its binding interpretations of the Constitution, have done a rather similar thing. But no matter which side of the Atlantic you look, the attitude is growing that man has the power to make law as he pleases, in accordance with the government's ideological goals or the nation's sociological trends. And no Bill of Rights or no constitution, no independent judiciary even, are a guarantee of that not happening. Positive law is fundamentally godless. And freedom can only be sustained in this land or any other land so long as legislature and judiciary and the people themselves feel themselves accountable to the higher law, the law of God. I suspect it's impossible to have democracy without that kind of theistic system underlying a national moral consensus. In the absence of such a self-regulating moral consensus within society, positive law inevitably steps in with its cramping, burdensome leviathan. An over-regulated society emerges, just like pre-war Germany, which is wide open to tyranny or anarchy, or both, as so often happens. Now, Christians of all people should know how dangerous all this is. We should know of all people how dangerous it is to obey the state too well. Christians of all people should know how easily it is, how easily the state which God appoints to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer is transformed into the beast who cruelly persecutes the people of God. Christians of all people should know how easily Satan insinuates himself on the side of law and order. Because we honour a Lord this morning who, just like Daniel, was the victim of an establishment plot. One who, just like Daniel, because he set his face to go to Jerusalem, found himself hounded to the scaffold in the name of justice. We have a law, and by that law he ought to die. That's exactly what they said. Well, they had a law, all right, but it wasn't the law of God, was it? Pilate should have known it. Deep in his heart, he did know it. But like Darius, he was too weak or too enmeshed in the constructs of his own legal system to overrule the injustice of it all. You could have no power at all over me unless it were given you from above, Jesus told him. He was trying to help Pilate to see the claim of the higher law over him. But such arguments for the higher law were lost on pragmatic Pilate. So Jesus died. One more victim of judicial murder, an innocent man, the most innocent man who's ever lived. Like Daniel, he didn't organize a revolution. He didn't stage a public protest. He barely even spoke in his own defense. Like Daniel, he just prayed. Your will be done, he said, and let them feed him to the lions. They put a stone over his tomb too, didn't they? And sealed it to make sure it was all legal and above board and nobody tampered with the evidence. But like Daniel, the higher law could not be set aside in that contemptuous fashion. He had come to proclaim the kingdom of God. And the sovereign rule of God was what was demonstrated in his mighty resurrection. He broke the chains of death to affirm the unchallengeable superiority of God's sovereign claim over our lives. All authority in heaven and earth is given to me, he says. And from that empty cross, there have come a stream of faithful men and women down through the ages who, like Daniel, have been courageous witnesses to his supreme authority. From Peter to Martin Luther King, perhaps you could say. We must obey God rather than men. Jesus is the only Lord. We Christians are not rebels. On the contrary, like Daniel, we want to see a society of which we are part, ruled with integrity and faithfulness, and we'll cooperate to that end, to our very best endeavours. But we will not bow to the tyranny of godless law. Every day we confess our unconditional loyalty to the prior claim of the kingdom of the living God, the God who endures forever, as Darius calls him. And that means, of course, what that means is there are certain kinds of political regime and certain kinds of social climate where it may very well be the only place a man or woman of God can be with integrity is in prison or on the scaffold. That's the nature of our faith. It's the nature of the absolutist and exclusive nature of our faith. We insist there is a truth which we must be willing to die for. Now, I don't say these words lightly. But any weakness in our stand on this point will leave us vulnerable in the hour of trial, in these last days, when paganism rules okay. It's all too easy to find yourself like the cowardly vicar of Bray, sacrificing integrity and consistency for expediency and survival. I'm sure you know about the vicar of Bray, minister of a small Berkshire village through the reigns of Charles II and through to the accession of George I 3 centuries ago. During his period in office, he changed his creed from Catholic to Protestant and back to Catholic again, with every wind of change in the monarchy. And when people asked him why he had been so fickle, his reply was, his greatest ambition in life was to live and die Vicar of Bray. Well, no such inconsistency is observable in this book of Daniel, see. These are of the stamp who, like Peter, must declare, judge for yourselves whether it is right to obey God or you. Notice, and it's important to notice this, when a Christian dissents in this way, it's not in the name of some alternative ideology. We don't disobey the government if we're forced into that situation simply because the government isn't democratic enough for our taste. No, godly governments are not godly by virtue of the way they are appointed in Scripture. They are godly by virtue of the way they perceive their own authority. A godly government is a government that perceives itself as accountable to the higher law. It is when the state no longer perceives itself in that way that Christian protest is vital. The Christian defiance of the state is always not in the name of the sovereignty of the people, that cruelest of all tyrannies. It's in the name of the sovereignty of God that the Christian must sometimes say, no. And in this country, we have cause to be grateful to many such brave Christians who, down through the centuries, have eschewed the easy path of compromise and safety, and like Daniel, have defied the king's command and refused to compromise their consciences and have drawn a line and said, there is an issue here we must make a stand for, even at the cost of our lives. And I think we have to think the question that haunts me very much at the end of the 20th century, is whether with the advance of secularism, the advance of pluralism, the increasing paganization of our society, we are not returning to the day when such a stand will be necessary, but are running painfully short of men and women ready to make it. Edmund Burke, you remember, in the 18th century, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. Was it John Kennedy, wasn't it, who said the hottest places in hell are reserved for those in time of great moral crisis who maintain their neutrality? One recalls perhaps the searching confession of Martin Niemöller here, who suffered under Hitler. In Germany, he says, they first came for the communists. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists. I didn't speak up because I wasn't in a trade union. Then they came for the Catholics. I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me. By that time, there was no one left to speak up. Well, make no mistake about it. The British Constitution can no more deliver us from tyranny than could the law of the Medes and Persians, no matter how much we respect and admire it. The freedom of this land has been purchased by the brave defiance of non-conformists, dare I say it, in such an Anglican emporium. Non-conformists like Daniel. And in the 21st century, we may need to be non-conformists again. Be faithful unto death, said Jesus to those Christians in the first century, and I will give you a crown of life. We Christians are different because we have a cause worth dying for. Christ does not ask of us the foolhardy bravado of the daredevil who risks his life for nothing. But he does ask of us the sane and thoughtful and sober courage of the martyr who is prepared to give his life for everything. And that's what, it seems to me, the gospel has always demanded as the price, the cost of discipleship. And the day is coming when we have got to teach our people that once again.